Hey there, True Crime Podcast fans. It's Patrick and Jillian from True Crime Obsessed.
Each week on TCO, we recap a true crime documentary everyone's talking about, and we do it with heart, sass, and just the right amount of humor.
So if you like the kind of podcast where two good friends chat about a case in a thoughtful way that centers the victims, you really got to check us out.
Yeah, we cover the well-known cases that you hear about in the news and the underreported cases that desperately need more attention.
For almost 9 years, we've been one of the most popular true crime podcasts out there.
We have over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, and our brand new YouTube channel has over 50,000 subscribers watching our full-length video episodes, too.
So find and subscribe True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.
G'day. I'd like to introduce you to a new podcast investigating Australia's most haunting unsolved mysteries. A millionaire heiress disappears from a mansion being consumed by swamp. A mountain that keeps its dead. An author's fictional murder method turned horrifyingly real. And deep in the Victorian Alps, a hermit known only as the Button Man. Welcome to Struth, where we explore Australia's most perplexing mysteries, where the official explanations don't quite add up, where witnesses were told to forget what they saw, where families still wait for answers. Struth, because in this sunburnt country, truth is stranger than any fiction we could imagine.
This episode of Felon may contain disturbing content, including descriptions of violence and coarse language. Listener discretion is advised.
Wirroorli is the kind of place that rarely makes the news. A quiet dot on the map in northeast Victoria, tucked between the vineyards of Milawa and the farming town of Myrtleford, the Ovens River winds its way past open paddocks, dairy herds graze under a big sky, and the streets are lined with weatherboard homes where everyone knows their neighbours. It's a small town with one school, a general store, and a recreation reserve that serves as the beating heart of the community. Life moves slowly here, marked by the cycles of harvest and the familiar faces at the local footy club. But in January of 2016, that calm was shattered. In a place where unusual cars stand out and strangers are noticed, the disappearance of Karen Cecuti rippled through Wirroorli like a shockwave. What happened here would expose the darkest of human impulses, set against the backdrop of one of Victoria's most unassuming country towns. Tuesday, 12th of January, 2016. Dawned hot in the Wangaratta district, the mercury climbed to 37 degrees, baking the fields, the back roads, and the small rural settlement of Wirroorli, where Karen Cecuti lived. Karen, 49, worked in the records department at the city of Wangaratta, but this evening, she was home alone, her two teenage children staying with their father. She lived on a 10-acre property, modest yet self-contained, surrounded by open paddocks, gum trees, and the occasional neighbouring farm. That evening, Karen decided to step out, making her way to the Wirroorli Hotel, a place she knew well. Years earlier, she and her husband had been publicans there, a chapter of her life that had ended but not been forgotten. By 6 o'clock, she was at the hotel, greeting familiar faces. She spoke with her neighbour, Brian Gambold, and shared a few words with Graham Wood, the current publican. She had a beer, relaxed, and enjoyed the small-town rhythm, casual conversation, friendly banter, and the comforting hum of a place where everyone knew each other. By 7:45 p.m., Karen left the hotel. She climbed into her red two-door Citroen coupe and drove the short distance back to her property, just a few hundred meters along the narrow country lane she had traveled countless times. At home, she had a meal and poured herself a glass of wine, settling into the quiet of her house. Perhaps she tended to chores, answered messages, or simply moved through the familiar spaces of her home, It was ordinary, comfortable, predictable. Karen's movements that night were unremarkable, almost mundane. She lived alone, with only the company of her house, her land, and the familiar sights of Waruli's rolling paddocks. Occasionally, she would see her neighbour, but historically, their contact had been minimal. Some sources later suggested she was unsettled by his occasional offers to help around her property, but that night, there was nothing to indicate danger. At 9 p.m, her final known communications began. Karen's phone records show her mobile active, still within reach. Her last messages on Facebook, sent around 9:18 p.m. No one knew at the time that these ordinary moments would be the last trace of Karen before tragedy struck. By the time the night stretched on, Karen was moving through her home in the warmth of the January evening, unaware of the events that would unfold in the shadows just beyond her property. Events that would take her from this familiar world and leave a quiet rural town haunted by what had happened. By the morning of Wednesday, 13th January, alarm bells were ringing. Karen had not arrived at her job as records coordinator at the city of Wangaratta. Detective Sergeant Saul Solomon from the Homicide Squad explained the concern. Karen, 49, had two children, aged 14 and 15. She didn't turn up for work on Wednesday, which is highly out of character for her, he said. She's well known as being highly punctual, highly thought of, and very efficient in her life. She had made no contact with anyone that day. A concerned friend, noting her absence, reported her missing. Police attempted to reconstruct her last known movements. Detective Sergeant Saul Solomon said they were trying to nail down exactly where she had been after leaving the Waruli Hotel the previous evening, but the hotel did not have CCTV cameras to provide a clear record. For the community of Waruli, the news was shocking. One of her friends, Greg Hazem, told Fairfax she was a major part of Waruli and a great mother to her two children, who are now staying with their father. The Wangaratta Chronicle described the town as left numb and dumbfounded. At her home, the scene suggested something was seriously wrong. Lights remained on, her handbag and purse were undisturbed, yet her phone was missing. Police would later note that the circumstances certainly paint a picture of the involvement of a second party in her disappearance. Friends and neighbors, desperate for information, turned to social media, sharing pictures of Karen and her 2004 red Citroen, a car that was unusual in the town, in the hope that someone, anyone, might remember seeing her that day. The quiet rhythms of Waruli had been disrupted, replaced by fear and uncertainty. A trusted neighbor, a friend, a mother, someone known to all, had vanished without a trace, leaving the town searching for answers. Later on the evening of the 13th of January, as the search for Karen continued, attention began to focus on tracing her movements that night. Reports surfaced of a neighbor who had interacted with her earlier, and suggestions were made about possible areas to search, including the vicinity of the Ovens River. At the time, it was shared that Karen had asked for some of the neighbor's homegrown tomatoes and had reportedly visited his property briefly after 9 p.m. A container of those tomatoes was later found in her fridge, offering a small clue about her evening before she disappeared. By Thursday, the 13th of January, the search for Karen had intensified, but a grim discovery added to the alarm. On Halls Road, near Myrtleford, about 20 kilometers from Waruli, the burned-out shell of Karen's red Citroen was found. On the afternoon of the 14th of January, 2016, police visited Michael Cardamone, a neighbor of Karen, to clarify his contact with her on the night of her disappearance. During this process, Cardamone provided a statement outlining his interactions with Karen. He described a conversation on the evening of the 12th of January and mentioned that Karen had stopped by to pick up some homegrown tomatoes. According to his account, they had spent some time chatting about what he summed up as everyday matters, and she left around 9:15 p.m. On Friday, the 15th of January, 2016, Michael Cardamone participated in an extended follow-up interview with Detective Senior Constables Wallace and Dodemaid from the Homicide Squad. During this conversation, responding to police and community member suspicions, he denied any involvement in her disappearance. He went on to express frustration that, due to his prior convictions and status on the Sexual Offender Register, local residents were pointing the finger at him. Cardamone also asserted that he hoped the police would either find Karen safely or apprehend whoever had done it. In the same discussion, he repeated his account of having had contact with Karen on the evening of Tuesday and suggested that the person responsible for her disappearance must have been waiting for her at her property. He claimed to have heard cars leaving at night and to have seen Karen's car later in Myrtleford. Saturday, the 16th of January, 2016, the solicitor of Michael Cardamone, Jeff Clancy, received a call that sent shockwaves through his office. Cardamone's voice was frantic, panicked. He claimed he had been kidnapped and was trapped in the boot of his own car by two unknown men. Clancy, alarmed by the urgency and fear in the call, immediately contacted police. Within moments, a description of Cardamone's vehicle was broadcast across Victoria. The call set off an intense and immediate response. Police scrambled to locate both the vehicle and the supposed kidnappers, treating every second as critical. What began as an already complex investigation suddenly spiraled into a tense statewide hunt, an unfolding drama that gripped officers, Cardamone's solicitor, and the wider community. In the early hours of Sunday, the 17th of January, police located Michael Cardamone's vehicle in the St Kilda area. Officers attempted to intercept the car, triggering a pursuit that lasted for more than an hour and concluded in Ringwood. When intercepted, there was no sign of kidnappers, and Cardamone himself was behind the wheel. In this bizarre twist, he was taken into custody for questioning. During the police interview that followed, Cardamone provided an account concerning the death of Karen Chidkuti. He introduced two alleged Lebanese men, claiming they must have been responsible. Cardamone stated that his knowledge of the events was limited because he and his family were purportedly under threat from these men. He further asserted that they had disclosed the location of Karen's body and that he would assist police in recovering it. Meanwhile, police and volunteers conducted searches in the Lake Buffalo area. Cardamone, through his legal counsel, later claimed that the reason police were searching there was based on information he had provided. In reality, police were acting on independent information regarding possible scuff marks at the spillway area of the lake. Statements made to police at that time were later found to be intentionally misleading, designed to divert attention from the truth. Late on the evening of the 17th of January, Cardamone was taken to Myrtleford by police, claiming he would show them where Karen's body was located. He led officers along various off-road tracks, giving the impression he was providing accurate directions. This continued into the early hours of the 18th of January. During this period, Cardamone offered multiple accounts of what had occurred to Karen. He initially alleged that two Lebanese men had restrained her in her car and threatened him to remain silent. He described, in graphic terms, purported acts of violence, including burning, bashing, and running over the victim. After being made aware that police had already conducted further inquiries, Cardamone abandoned the narrative involving the two men. His account shifted once more, now claiming that an acquaintance named Eddie George had killed Karen, while admitting that he had been present during the events. Later on the 18th of January, while in the holding cell at Wangaratta Police Station, Cardamone spoke with Detective Sergeant Dolan and provided a new account of events. He stated that he was not the one who knocked her, and that it was all Eddie. Cardamone described Eddie being at his property in Warrouli, and while Karen was there having coffee, he claimed Eddie had placed an animal tranquilizer in her drink. He alleged that Eddie then got into her car with her, and later returned to Cardamone's house with her in the boot. According to Cardamone, Eddie killed her by running over her, and also attempted to light her on fire. Cardamone expressed frustration at repeatedly telling this account, and complained that Eddie was now shifting blame onto him. He indicated he could show police the location of the events. That morning, police drove Cardamone toward the Lake Buffalo area to facilitate this. However, before they reached the location, at approximately 12:55 p.m., searchers discovered Karen's body 35 kilometers from Myrtleford in an area known as Dandonga Dale. Photographs from the scene indicate the shocking state of the body, a horrifying discovery for those present. Police did not inform Cardamone that Karen's body had been located. Despite this, he directed officers to the exact location of her death. At the scene, Cardamone described removing Karen from the car, removing her clothing, and gagging her mouth. He claimed Eddie doused her with petrol, injected battery acid into her arm, and ignited the petrol, during which she could be heard screaming through the gag. Cardamone also stated that Eddie reversed over her with the car and then pushed her to the side. Karen's discarded clothing was later found in the blackberries, as documented in crime scene photographs. On the 19th of January, a post-mortem examination was conducted on Karen Chetcuti's remains. The findings revealed the extreme violence of the attack inflicted upon her. Toxicology showed the presence of methamphetamine and xylazine, a powerful veterinary sedative. It was also noted that Karen had been injected with battery acid. The immediate cause of death was determined to be the effects of burning, combined with blunt force trauma to the head and torso. Michael Cardamone was born on the 19th of April, 1967, the son of Italian immigrants, and grew up on his family's tobacco farm in Wangaratta. He has a younger sister, 4 years his junior. Cardamone completed his education to year 12 and, following the death of his father, took over management of the family's farming properties. Life for Cardamone was marked by social difficulties, and he began using drugs, including amphetamines, from his teenage years. His early criminal history began at 18, with convictions for assault, and later extended to offences involving theft and dishonesty. By the early 2000s, his record also included drug-related matters. In 2006, Cardamone was convicted of serious sexual offences committed against a 15-year-old girl who was living on his family farm at the time. The attack involved the use of a wrench to threaten the victim and force compliance with a number of sexual acts. Cardamone received a custodial sentence with a non-parole period of 6 years and was registered as a serious sexual offender for life. After release, his parole was repeatedly varied and, on multiple occasions, cancelled between 2012 and 2015. At the time of his arrest in relation to Karen's case, he had 274 days remaining on his parole. By January 2016, Cardamone was living with his mother in Waruli, adjacent to the property of Karen Chetkuti, a neighbour that Karen had shared on a number of occasions to those close to her that she felt uneasy being around. When Karen went missing, at first, Michael Cardamone positioned himself as a concerned neighbour, offering explanations for his contact with Karen and even suggesting search areas. His statements gave the impression of someone trying to help, a bystander caught up in events rather than the central figure. But as investigators pieced together the evidence, from witness accounts to forensic discoveries, it became clear that Cardamone's role was far more direct. Eventually, he admitted to being present at Karen's murder, a revelation that transformed the focus of the investigation. What had initially appeared as the account of a cooperative neighbor now revealed the chilling truth. He had been a participant in the crime, and his actions that night were central to her death. Police began to scrutinize every detail of Cardamone's movements and statements, his earlier accounts, stories about errands, casual chats, and even fictitious encounters were now examined under a new light. Investigators compared his narratives with witness statements, timelines, and forensic evidence, uncovering discrepancies and attempts to misdirect. Cardamone had repeatedly offered explanations that seemed designed to appear helpful, even going so far as to suggest search locations and provide innocent reasons for his contact with Karen. At the time, these gestures masked the true severity of his involvement. As detectives analyzed the sequence of events on the night of the 12th of January, it became increasingly clear that he had not been a passive observer. His presence at Karen's property coincided with the moments she was abducted and ultimately murdered. This revelation marked a turning point in the investigation. What had started as a puzzling disappearance now had a central figure whose admission placed him at the scene of the crime, forcing police to reconstruct the events with him at the center. Every prior statement, every attempt to redirect suspicion, became a critical piece of the puzzle in understanding not only what had happened to Karen, but also the calculated steps Cardamone took to obscure his involvement. The sequence of events that followed was gradually pieced together through the overwhelming evidence, allowing investigators to reconstruct the tragic final movements of Karen Chetkuti and the violent acts of Michael Cardamone. On the morning of Tuesday, the 12th of January, 2016, Michael Cardamone was in contact with Eddie George in Myrtleford, seeking to obtain methamphetamine, reflecting his long-standing dependence on the drug. That evening, at around 9 p.m, Cardamone's mother began looking for him. Minutes later, at 9:09 p.m, he called Karen Chetkuti's mobile phone, but she did not answer. Around this time, Karen's last known activity on social media occurred, with her final Facebook message sent at 9:18 p.m. Cardamone would later claim to police that Karen had visited his property shortly after 9:15 p.m. to collect cherry tomatoes. By 9:40 p.m, Cardamone made another call to Karen, which lasted just over a minute. Additional contact between their phones was recorded around 9:55 p.m, though it is unlikely Karen participated in these calls. Evidence indicates that between 9:18 and 10:30 p.m, Cardamone physically attacked Karen, restraining her with cable ties, duct tape, and rope. For a period of time afterward, she was left either on her property or in a shed on Cardamone's property, where he was later observed cleaning the floor. At around 10:30 p.m, Cardamone made further contact with Eddie George and drove Karen's Citroen to Myrtleford, with phone records showing both his and Karen's phones in that area. After obtaining methamphetamine, Cardamone returned to Waruli in Karen's vehicle, arriving close to midnight. In the early hours of Wednesday, the 13th of January, Cardamone returned to Myrtleford in Karen's car. left it parked, and returned to his home by taxi around 3:30 a.m. He then took his own four-wheel drive and drove back towards Myrtleford with Karen. Phone tower records indicate he spent approximately 2.5 hours in the Lake Buffalo area. During this period, Cardamone administered both xylazine and methamphetamine to Karen. He inflicted severe blunt force trauma, fracturing her skull and ribs. At some point, he also injected Karen with battery acid. She was bound and gagged, doused with petrol, and set alight. Toxicology and post-mortem findings show she was alive during the burning, inhaling gases, and suffering thermal injuries. After her death, Cardamone drove over her body with the four-wheel drive, causing additional fractures to her vertebrae, pelvis, and scapula. Her body was then left off to the side of the track, near the burnt patch, a final, grim scene captured in crime scene photographs. Early on the 13th of January, 2016, after the events of the previous night, Cardamone returned to Myrtleford. He visited a Caltex service station, where he purchased 2 cigarette lighters, before being observed on CCTV walking barefoot, having apparently disposed of his shoes. He then attended a nearby car wash, running his four-wheel drive through the wash for 8 minutes. Later, he returned to the same car wash for a second wash, and in the afternoon, made a third visit, this time combining washing with vacuuming around the driver's door. Throughout the day, he was also seen driving Karen's red Citroen. By the evening, Cardamone was aware of police interest in Karen's disappearance. He approached officers searching for her, providing a series of fabricated explanations about the last time he had seen her and the reason for their contact. He suggested areas along the Ovens River for searches, knowing these directions would be futile. In support of his story, he claimed Karen had visited his home to collect cherry tomatoes. A search of Karen's fridge had revealed a container of tomatoes, although only one set of fingerprints were lifted from it, those being Cardamone's. Later that night, Cardamone again went to Myrtleford to meet Eddie George, obtaining methamphetamine and arranging for George's assistance with a motor vehicle. In reality, he was planning to destroy Karen's Citroen. Around 4:30 a.m. on the 14th of January, the car was taken to Halls Road, near Lookout Hill, and set on fire, with George driving Cardamone's vehicle at the scene. Both left the location in Cardamone's patrol, leaving the Citroen destroyed. That afternoon, police came to Cardamone's home, requesting a formal statement. He provided a sworn account of his contact with Karen, detailing a fabricated conversation about tomatoes and claiming that the last time he saw her was at 9:15 p.m. The following day, Cardamone initially set out with his mother and sister for a holiday to Lake's Entrance, but abandoned the trip after a short distance, suggesting the investigation weighed heavily on him. Later, he had an extended conversation with Detective Senior Constables Wallace and Dodemaid from the Homicide Squad. He maintained false denials of involvement in Karen's disappearance, complaining that local people were pointing the finger at him due to his status on the Sexual Offenders Register, and claiming he hoped police found her safely or that the person responsible was caught. He also spoke to a journalist from The Age, admitting he had been in contact with Karen on Tuesday and asserting that the person responsible must have been waiting for her when she returned home. On the 16th of January, Cardamone escalated his deception. At 1:47 p.m., he called his solicitor, Jeff Clancy, claiming he had been kidnapped by 2 Lebanese men and was being held in the boot of his car. Clancy immediately alerted police, and a description of Cardamone's vehicle was circulated across Victoria. In reality, Cardamone was in Melbourne, travelling in his white Holden Calais and withdrawing cash from ATMs. In the early hours of Sunday, the 17th of January, police spotted Cardamone's vehicle in the St Kilda area. When they attempted to intercept him, a pursuit ensued that lasted over an hour, eventually ending in Ringwood, where he was taken into custody. The evidence, including phone records, witness accounts, and physical findings, made the prosecution's case on the charge of murder undeniable. Consequently, he was formally charged. On the 19th of January, after his arrest and formal charge, Cardamone was remanded to the Metropolitan Remand Centre. He knew that Eddie had already given a statement to police about helping to destroy Karen's car, and that, as a result, Eddie would be a prosecution witness. By September 2016, while still on remand in Melbourne, he struck up a rapport with another inmate, referred to in the records as BC. What began as conversation soon turned to the case. At first, Cardamone told BC a version that shifted primary blame onto Eddie, claiming he had merely been present when Karen was killed. Over time, and in repeated discussions, his story changed. He admitted to BC that he had murdered Karen and disclosed a sexual interest in her. He gave BC a detailed account of what he said he had done and why. Cardamone became fixated on the risk posed by Eddie's evidence. He described Eddie as a big problem and asked BC if he knew anyone who, for payment, could kill Eddie so that Cardamone might avoid the consequence of the case against him. From his perspective, this would remove a key witness and potentially assist his defense. BC reported the nature of Cardamone's conversations to police. Acting on that information, through BC, officers provided Cardamone with the contact details of a man said to be able to carry out the task. A man who was, in fact, a covert police operative, using the name Matty Thompson. Over a number of conversations, including a face-to-face meeting in custody on the 6th of March 2017, Cardamone and Thompson agreed terms. The plan, as negotiated by Cardamone, was that Eddie would be murdered and the death staged to appear as a drug overdose suicide. Eddie would be forced to write confession letters, taking responsibility for Karen's death. Cardamone supplied Thompson with details about where Eddie could be found and reiterated his version of events that blamed Eddie for Karen's death. Cardamone promised to pay $25,000 for the killing. Due to being in custody, the arrangement was that the money would be delivered in two installments by his mother, Maria Cardamone. On the 23rd of March, 2017, Maria handed a package containing $9,000 to another undercover operative as a partial payment. On the 29th of March, 2017, Cardamone was told that Eddie had been murdered and was to be shown a photograph of the deceased, material he said should be shown to his mother. At that point, police intervened and the sting was ended. Cardamone was charged with incitement to murder. His mother was also charged. The alleged plot was not only an attempt to eliminate a prosecution witness, but an attempt to pervert the course of justice by manufacturing evidence and concealing a murder. Inciting murder carries a maximum penalty of life imprisonment. The court noted that Cardamone's conduct, spanning the period from 12th of January 2016 through to his guilty plea on 30th June 2017, demonstrated a sustained effort to avoid responsibility and, in the view of the sentencing judge, showed no genuine remorse. When psychiatrists assessed Michael Cardamone, they found a man who was largely unwilling to talk about why he had killed Karen Ciccuti or go into the details of what he had done. Dr. Lester Walton, who saw him on July 17, 2017, noted that Cardamone had no significant mental health disorders, he wasn't psychotic, and there was nothing in his psychiatric history that could explain or excuse his actions. What was clear was a long history of drug abuse, heroin and methamphetamine in more recent years, echoing patterns observed as far back as 2006. He had little insight into his own behavior and the impact of his actions, and while he now suffered from mixed anxiety and depression, this was more a consequence of his circumstances than a factor in his offending. According to Dr. Walton, Cardamone expressed that he felt bad for what he had done and showed concern for the families affected. He became tearful during the assessment and appeared to express sorrow, even empathy, for the victim's family. But the psychiatrist made no claim about whether these reactions were genuine. Supreme Court Justice Lex Lasry sentenced Michael Cardamone to life imprisonment without the possibility of parole, calling the murder extraordinarily vicious, callous, and thoroughly unprovoked. When delivering the sentence, Justice Lasry acknowledged that refusing a minimum term was an exceptional measure. He described Karen Ciccuti's murder as depraved, extraordinarily vicious, and entirely unprovoked, noting that Cardamone's prospects for rehabilitation were virtually non-existent. He stated, "It is true that civilization is judged by how we treat people like you, and very often mercy is appropriate. However, sometimes a crime is so horrific, so cruel and so callous, that a step toward mercy becomes too difficult to take."
Felon True Crime.
there, True Crime Podcast fans. It's Patrick and Jillian from True Crime Obsessed.
Each week on TCO, we recap a true crime documentary everyone's talking about, and we do it with heart, sass, and just the right amount of humor.
So if you like the kind of podcast where two good friends chat about a case in a thoughtful way that centers the victims, you really got to check us out.
Yeah, we cover the well-known cases that you hear about in the news and the underreported cases that desperately need more attention.
For almost 9 years, we've been one of the most popular true crime podcasts out there.
We have over 30,000 five-star reviews on Apple Podcasts, and our brand new YouTube channel has over 50,000 subscribers watching our full-length video episodes, too.
So find and subscribe True Crime Obsessed wherever you get your podcasts.